right after that, in 1978, I went down for my first Chiefs of Missions Conference, which was held in Hong Kong on the, from the 5th through the 5th and 6th of January. Actually, just 2 days. And in that conference, I was urged by Dick Holbrook in making my report to lay out what I thought the development should be, so that there could be a general discussion of that. There wasn't that much discussion because most were, I think, taken by surprise. Although Len Unger, who of course was then our ambassador in Taipei, I was told in one of the recesses, said to a couple that, well, maybe this means I won't spend the rest of my life in Taiwan. Because you remember, he was scheduled to leave and they didn't want to replace him, and so just kept him there.
Most of the ambassadors would have been supportive of normalization, too, wouldn't they?
Yes, they were. And most were intrigued and supportive of what I was saying. Mike Mansfield certainly was. Of course,
yes.
I had discussed this with him before on my way in and out of China, because Narita was not yet open, so that when we went into the downtown airport?
I don't remember. Haneda.
Haneda. I'd always stay overnight at the residence, whereas when it shifted to Narita, that got to be such a chore going in and out that usually I went straight through. And also, I had a series of press interviews in connection with that in Hong Kong. I'm looking at the list now, the South China Morning Post, Reuters, Norman Pearlsteel, and Frank Ching for the Wall Street Journal, the Asian Wall Street Journal, Jay Matthews of Washington Post, John Kam, well, he was for the National Committee on U.S.-China Trade, but he was also for their house organ, I guess. Linda Matthews for the L.A. Times.
All the people who eventually came up to Peking,
right,
to be with you.
And June Chaplin for the American Chamber of Commerce publication. And particularly the Matthews wrote very favorable stories. And all of them put accent on my optimism as to the future of U.S.-China relations. And that was interesting because not too long after I got back to Peking, Tolstikov, the Soviet ambassador, asked for a meeting with me and wanted to know why I was so optimistic. And I said something to the effect that I was optimistic because it was the obviously sensible thing to do. This government, apart from any other consideration, did represent China. Should be that kind of relationship. And he said, absolutely, absolutely wrong. So I said, well, do you think the government in Taiwan represents China? Well, no. At that point, we dropped the conversation. But I was deliberately upbeat, also because of what I hope would be the impact on the Chinese. Kennedy also came at this point down through Hong Kong, and I I joined his press conference, which he held at the airport on his way to Tokyo. And he put considerable emphasis on, not on the same point, the tactical points, but on the goal.
You know, at that point, this was, as you're reviewing your activities in January, this was my low point during my time in Washington. I thought that there was a good possibility that I would be back at Michigan by late 1978. I saw no immediate prospect for normalization. We were locked in the Panama Canal battle with an uncertain outcome. It was clear that if that vote were lost, the president would not have the capacity to normalize. And in addition, I thought that our first year in East Asia was not a particularly good one. We had become involved in the Korean troop withdrawal as our major initiative in the region. There was no sense of the administration's determination to sustain a vital American presence in Southeast Asia. There were difficulties in generating arms sales to Thailand and to Indonesia. The situation in the Philippines was murky with our human rights emphasis on Marcos. Mike Armacost and I, therefore, in late December, wrote a memo for Zbigs. Zbig requested each region to write a memo.
Mike, at this point, was...
was my colleague on the NSC staff.
Right.
He handled Japan, and he was the main person who introduced me to how the federal government works. So he and I together drafted a memo on, at Zbig's request, on our first year in East Asia, and we gave ourselves about a C to C-plus for having tackled peripheral issues, not having dealt with major issues, this flirtation with Vietnam, also not central to what we thought our strategic emphasis ought to be. And I believe that Brzezinski gave that to the president. He gave him an overall report card. He prepared a summary of all the reports from around the world. And I think it was at about this time, maybe even a little earlier, that he had concluded that he had to really work hard for normalization. He saw that in his personal power interest, how he could undoubtedly, I've never talked to him about this, but I guess he saw how he could use this to strengthen his own position among the constellation of policymakers. But the battle then in Washington began to be fought over the next 2 months as to whether China was to be accorded a higher emphasis in the overall range of activities of the administration. And we'll come then to your February visit, but your February visit then was an important one against the background of a sense of lethargy. And more than that, among those of us who are most committed to moving forward on China.
Your mentioning human rights brings back to my mind that Pat Darien attended the Chiefs of Missions Conference and was accompanied by, who was the Cy Vance's public relations person?
Hodding Carter.
Hodding Carter. Hodding was with her. At least at the beginning, I was not aware of their relationship. I guess I became aware of it during the course of the 2 days. But she, of course, was a crusader on the issue. I don't have to tell you that. Without any regard, in my opinion, for the realistic situation involved. And she had she was on the agenda just before the lunch break, probably the second day. And she was really tearing into the Philippines situation and to others with some mild demurring. There were career people in all these, in all the posts that were under her gun. And I just sat there and finally, I took up the issue about I want to have to be, have due regard for the national interest that, that one couldn't just be blindly committed to what was an ideological matter in effect and pursue that regardless of the consequences. And Harding, who had not been a participant, I guess it was afterwards I wanted to know why he came charging in. And they were very unhappy with me because here was I, one of Carter's men. and she had kept saying about every third sentence was that this is the president's position. This is the president, which probably was. But I assumed that that kind of meeting was one for discussing policy and its impact and for feedback, not simply to receive the message. But it was interesting. When she left, she sent me a letter which I should get, which in effect absolved me, that despite my being caught up in the China issue, I still, our operation had seen it objectively, and one of the few places that got her imprimatur. But on that day in Hong Kong, they of course, as we broke up for lunch, all the career people all came up and shook my hand, which didn't help matters. Which didn't help
matters.
Well,
she was quite fearsome. She tried to intrude on China policy throughout 1979. She wished to give a speech on human rights in China. In fact, Dick Holbrooke bore a heavy cross in his dealings with the Human Rights Bureau. But in one case, she was ready to give a speech and had not sent it to EA, and it had not been cleared. And under the NSC guidelines, actually, an NSC staff person was supposed to clear the speech of every assistant secretary. This is one of the sources of tension between the two. So I had a right to clear her speech. And I got into a horrible fight with her at about 8 o'clock at night, and she was going to give the speech the next day. And I said I was prepared to take it up all the way to the top. And that forced her to relent. But I said, I'm very concerned about human rights in China, but, you know, we want to advance them, and speeches may harm them, what you seek to promote. And she said, well, she wanted me to know that every night before she went to bed, she thought about the human rights of 1 million Chinese and prayed for them. I didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
I remember at the end of this sharp exchange we had, she tried to put in my mouth that I was saying that everything was fine in China. I said, I'm not saying that at all. Well, there are things wrong. I said, well, when I left, it was still a communist society. Months later, the Australian ambassador in Peking, in a small group, was chuckling about this, how I had said to Pat Derrion that he reassured her that China was still communist, so that obviously one or more people there had fed that into the professional grapevine. But the almost blind pursuit of that policy could have had very dangerous consequences.
That's right.
When I said the national interest was paramount to all other policies, national security was paramount. That's what really got me for the time being, the concentrated fury. And on my way back from Hong Kong, I went to Shanghai because Alan Cranston had brought a very distinguished congressional delegation.
That was a White House delegation.
A White House delegation, but it was mixed, Senate and House.
That's right.
That's the first time I met, for example, Steve Solars, whom at first I found very irritating because he is really dogged in his pursuit. But very quickly I learned to have a considerable admiration for him. And so I met with them in Shanghai and had a very interesting exchange, in which again I was pursuing the line that I had developed, and it was in that regard that Solars was really going after me in what actually proved to be irritating at the time, but very useful because it helped sharpen my concentration.
It was friendly questioning from him, whether he was supportive of normalization.
I realized that afterwards.
Yes.
I didn't realize it at the time. My first reaction was that this is just a smart aleck. But it was very friendly, and it's just his matter.
Right.
Manner. He's a master of the Socratic method. I've seen him do it very well. Then the Cranston delegation had to make a hurried, most of them, a hurried exit from China because of the Hubert Humphrey funeral in Minneapolis. And I think that was the first time, I think, that the Chinese allowed an Air Force plane to overnight awaiting their arrival down in Canton.
That's correct. That was another sign we used as a signal of Chinese desire to move forward in the relationship.
Right.
We made a request on short notice to have an Air Force plane land in Canton, and they acceded to the request.
Right. Richmond was also, the House was also on that.
And Bill, was Bill Alexander on that one? Steve Neal of North Carolina, one of those two, I think.
No, Bill came to China four times while I was there, but I don't.
That wasn't his first trip?
I don't think so. He may have been.
And then some good senators on that also.
Now, who else was there besides Cranston?
He had a Republican. Who was the co-leader who was a Republican? I don't remember.
But it was,
I have a list.
By and large, a friendly group. And one of the mornings we were upstairs.
Packwood,
right. Right. Packwood, he was the co-chairman. Otto Preminger was in the hotel because he'd come to China for the purpose of making a film on the life of Norman Bethune. And he discovered while he was there the Chinese had similar plans. But we're at a breakfast table for round table for 10. He really getting very lyrical about the Chinese achievements in filmmaking. And not to be argumentative, but I had seen the film studio in Changchun, which I described earlier. Their product was pretty good, but their techniques were primitive. And so I thought, well, possibly in Shanghai and in Peking, where he had been, he had not been to Changchun, so maybe they're different. And so I began to question him, well, do they have, don't they do it this way, don't do it that way, and discovered that for all practical purposes, it was the same thing. Studios there were the same as the one I had seen in Changchun. Then he said how good the Chinese had been to him. Of course, he was all by himself, you know, in his 80s. And he said they had even supplied two people who were with him all the time, just out of sheer friendship. Now, what possessed me, I said, well, it's not entirely out of sheer friendship. And that he got very upset. He really berated me. Was I really the American representative in China? And I'm sure he went back and told his friends, we have a fascist son of a bitch representing us in Peking.
You know, as you mentioned, Hubert Humphrey, let's just pause for a second on that in two ways. I very much regretted his absence during the normalization fight. He, I think, would have had an impact on the Taiwan Relations Act and would have been a very strong force for the administration, not only in China policy, but his absence was really sorely missed for many issues. Secondly, I met him only once. I'm sure you had many, many dealings with him. But in the one occasion that I met him, I went up to brief a number of senators on normalization. And this was the Senate, an informal meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I went up with, I think, Harry Thayer and Bill Gleistein. I don't think Dick Holbrook was there, maybe I'm wrong. But the four of us made short presentations on normalization. A couple went through the basic arguments for it. Percy asked some questions, others asked questions. Humphrey came in midway through the meeting, sensed immediately what was going on, but continued to let the discussion unfold. And then he intervened with about 20 minutes left and summarized the situation, the impasse we found ourselves in, what would be needed, why it was the right thing to do, all in 5 eloquent minutes. And he said more in those 5 minutes than any of us had said in an hour. He totally understood the issue.
Well, Hubert Humphrey was a remarkable man, and he and I had a close relationship over the years, but it was a checkered one, more because of what I did than what he did. Humphrey had always been close to organized labor, and he'd been particularly close to the UAW and to Walter Reuther from the time that he was mayor of Minneapolis, and then when he was first elected to the Senate, and led the fight in the Philadelphia Convention of the Democratic Party in 1948 for civil rights. And I remember in the 52 convention, civil rights plank in the platform was again a hot, contentious issue. And I was working with Orville Freeman. And he and I are going from delegation to delegation, and finally, about 3 o'clock in the morning, Freeman was then governor of Minnesota, and of course, part of the Humphrey coalition, said to me, I don't know why I'm doing this. The Negroes are only 5% of the Minnesota population. And we were dog tired, but that's the way they were. And Hubert was very upset. when in 1960 I supported Kennedy. And then in 68, I was initially for Bob Kennedy, as I said, until he was killed in June of that year. And then I dropped out, not out of any antipathy to Hubert Humphrey, but I felt that he had to break with Johnson on the question of the war. And I remain convinced to this day that had he made his Salt Lake City speech a month before he did, he would have won that election. Or had the election campaign lasted another month, a week, he would have won. And the last time, as a footnote to that, that I introduced Hubert Humphrey, he came to Wayne State University to dedicate the Reuther Library, which the UIW had funded. And we had a packed house, about 400 people, Republicans and Democrats, that kind of an audience. When I introduced him, I finished my introduction by saying, if the campaign of 1968 had lasted one more week, this man would have been president of the United States, and how different our history would have been, and the place blew the roof off. At this time, Carter was already president, I think, because Ray Marshall was also on the program. I may have that mixed up, but. In 72, again, I grievously disappointed Hubert because an issue in the convention, finally, was the seating of the California delegation. They had been elected under the unit rule, and they were all for McGovern. Those who were trying to block McGovern were trying to upset the California, not to seat the California delegation. And the UIW made a decision to support the seating. First of all, they had been elected under the rules, it was proper, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a roll call vote on that question. When Hubert Humphrey went in that roll call vote, seated the delegation by a fairly narrow margin. I'll never forget Hubert Humphrey walking off the floor and saying to the television and radio, well, the difference was the UAW in Michigan and Indiana and Illinois, they switched enough delegates to beat us tonight. And he said it with, not with bitterness, but with such disappointment. And yet, despite those things, in 1976, I was with Carter, as I described. And again, by this time, he was getting used to it. But I remember when he wrestled with himself so long, and finally, if you remember, there was great pressure on him to get into the last open primary in New Jersey.
That's right. Yeah.
So that if he could win there, he would have a base, deadlock the convention. From his point of view and his supporters, the convention would turn to him. And he finally announced that after great deliberation, he had decided to withdraw and not contest it. And when they asked Jimmy Carter what he thought about it, said something to the effect, I wish he'd just stayed in, I'd have whipped him. And I remember calling Governor Carter and saying, of course, in those days he was Jimmy, why did you do that? We're going to have to put this party together to win the election. Hubert Humphrey's people are legion. They go far beyond those who support him as a candidate. And he said, well, I shouldn't have done it. I'd be interested to know why he why he did that. It was so unnecessary.
Well, Carter had that impulse on more than one occasion of, you know, kicking a guy, you know, the seat as he's going out the door. And they had a bit of that in him.
Yeah, but it was unfortunate. It's so unnecessary.
Right. No.
But,
right.
But after I was nominated, I, of course, went to see Hubert. Not only because he was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but also because of our friendship. I might say in 1960, the Minnesota delegation and the Michigan delegation were both housed in the old Statler Hilton in Los Angeles. And he was on the same floor that I was. And he used to go by me without seeing me. I don't think he was snubbing me. Literally didn't. He was in such a shock in that convention.
Huh.
He
thought he had a chance?
Well,
that was after West Virginia.
After West Virginia. But it was generally accepted in that convention, Mike, that if Kennedy had not taken it on the first ballot, or at least the second, that his strength would begin to dissipate and that anything could happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I was a member of the Michigan delegation, and the votes, there were quite a few votes I had lined up for Kennedy, who kept saying to me, "Your boy, you better win on the first ballot, or our commitment only goes for one ballot." So that, yes, he still mm-hmm. thought he had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Minnesota delegation in that convention distinguished itself. Hubert was a candidate. Orville Freeman nominated Kennedy. And Eugene McCarthy nominated Adlai Stevenson.
I forgot that.
In fact, McCarthy made a very eloquent speech for Stevenson.
Yes, that was the beginning of his political career.
Right. And they, the Stevenson people had control of the convention procedures because they packed the balcony and they brought Eleanor Roosevelt in. And she moved from one section of the balcony to another. And, of course, the floor managers allowed them onto the floor. And it was packed. And you couldn't get to your doubtful delegates to find out if they were being affected by all this mass demonstration, but everything stayed put. But in the sessions that I had with him, I had two or three, he was so helpful and so full of advice. That, he was truly one of the most human people.
Did you talk to him after you had been nominated ambassador to China?
This is what I'm talking about.
Oh, you did, and two or three times.
Yes, this was when I was nominated to be head of the liaison office.
I see.
In 77.
I see. Already waning because of cancer. Very clearly approaching the end.
Already beginning to show it physically, but with really an indomitable spirit.
Hmm.
And,
did he think that normalization would occur in the Carter administration?
I'm not sure either one of us did. We both agreed that it was something that was necessary and needed.
Did he talk to you at all about the politics of it, of what it would take to bring the Senate along?
That would be a difficult problem, and we would work. I could count on him, work closely with him, and rather than any specific.
No specific.
It was something that was in the future. I see on my notes here that The meeting I had, that I mentioned before, with Soviet Ambassador Tolstikov took place in my residence on the morning of January the 17th. Also in that January, the Baba Booth brought the first delegation from the First National Bank of Chicago to China. And he had a scent of what was going to happen, I think. Before many others, and I think in that visit went quite far in offering to make arrangements with the Chinese. And then also another straw in the wind, the Canadian National Defense College group came to China, including four Americans in the delegation. Maybe this is a straw in the other direction. The Chinese told the Canadian ambassador that they would not receive the Americans. And the Canadian ambassador informed them if there were no Americans, there'd be no delegation. At that point, the Chinese relented, and the delegation came with the four American representatives, one from the Army, the Air Corps, the Air Force, the Navy. And I think a civilian representative of DOD. And also in that January, I had my first encounter with Charles Abrams, who's...
With Hugh Scott?
Well, I think he had Hugh Scott, but I met with him. I had lunch with him separately.
When did maybe Hugh Scott joined up with him later?
I think so. Yes, I think so. I don't remember the two of them ever coming to China together.
I believe they did. I believe there was one trip.
It would have been at the time when I wasn't in Peking.
They went together in connection with the Huxian peasant art exhibit.
Ah, yes, right.
And Scott, I think, got involved in that.
Yeah, it was in that January. They were together at that time, but I didn't meet them together. That was it. Then to my last close encounter with the Soviets was on Sunday the 29th of January. And I remember this too because it was the first public appearance that Sharon and I made together. The Soviets, their embassy of course covered a large area of ground, and they had a lake on the grounds, which at this time of year of course was frozen solid, and on which they had an ice rink and hockey games. It would be the Russia against the world. And so we went on this Sunday morning, the last Sunday in January, to see the hockey game. And along with with my DCM, David Bean, and his wife, I had couple of days before that taken David and his wife into my confidence relative to Sharon. And I remember it was in the second period, I think, Tolstikov has me sitting beside him watching the game from a bridge which went over the stream that fed the lake. And quite a close game. The Soviets hadn't lost a game, but this one was the the opposition team, which was mostly Canadian. Some of the Soviet players, I'm sure, were ringers. they were brought in with their hockey capacity. And he said, it's cold, let's go to the house and have a drink. So he takes the other ambassadors who were there. There was a Turkish ambassador, I remember, and we all go to his residence, divide, of course, men in one room, the women in another, although just an arch divided us, and start drinking vodka. This is at 11 o'clock in the morning. And I remember in the next room, his wife, and they were typical Russians, like you think of people appearing when they're Russian peasants. Really quite a likable couple. She starts singing in the next room, Ochichornia. And he perks up. There was a big music box in the corner. The room we were in was not very big. And he goes over and searches through the records and finds a record with Ochichornia on it. And he's having trouble putting it on and setting up the machine, and his wife comes in with her hip, pushes him on one side, and fixes it up, turns on the music, and he goes to the volume knob and turns it up as loud as it would go. The poor Turkish ambassador was right next to the machine. He's putting his hand up to his ears. But we had to listen to the music. And then I finally said to the ambassador, I said, I'd like to see the rest of that game, but I would like to offer one last toast. He had been there at this point about almost 7 years. And I said, my toast is that I will stay in Peking long enough U.S. representative to be your deputy when you are dean of the diplomatic corps.
Yeah.
It was translated for him, and he said in English, "Oh God, no." And he left the following. He left the following June. And if I may digress a minute. At the point he gave his farewell reception, Doug Fraser and his wife and his secretary, who had been my former secretary, Mary Wenzel, who is Russian and Russian-speaking. She was born in this country, but from Russian stock. We took her with us to the reception, and she got along fine with Mrs. Tolstikov. After the formal toasts are out of the way, he's walking through the crowd with his glass of champagne. And his interpreter is saying, the ambassador is saying how sorry he is to leave this lovely country, although he, of course, is glad to go back home to Leningrad. Mary Wenzel says, he's not saying that at all. He's saying, I'll be so glad to get out of this awful place. It can't come too soon. And he's going through repeating this all the time. He was quite a person.
Do you think he knew that the interpreter was mistranslating, so he was just having a good time?
Oh, I think so. Yes, I think so. I'm sure the interpreter wouldn't have done that without previous understanding. And at that point came my return to the United States. The question then was, David Dean was leaving in the following June, and there were several applicants to be DCM, and I was given the opportunity to...
Who were they?
Were the applicants?
Yes. Stape, obviously.
Gleistein, not Bill, his brother, was one.
Uh-huh. Culver.
Yes, right. A man who then was the Consul General in Brazil, Argentina.
Drexler.
Drexler.
Bob Drexler, who was then...